Hello. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. My name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which republishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. And there are a lot of stories this week, starting with one which relates to an important sector for our state, agriculture. Drought, rising fuel costs strain North Carolina farmers. And this article is by Morgan Casey. Jerry Robinson gazed out at his strawberry field in Whiteville as workers searched for fruit ready for picking. Hundreds of white blooms dotted the long rows of strawberry plants, thanks to much-needed rainfall that recently softened the parched earth. Robinson said the small flowers are a good sign for the remaining strawberry season. He's confident he can sell the crop at his produce stand next month. But the harsh winter and ongoing drought have taken a toll on Robinson Produce Farms, which grows seasonal crops and flowers across 150 acres in Columbus County. The business is weeks behind in strawberry production compared with this time last year. "You can't go back and make up those few weeks that you lost on sales," Robinson, a 62-year-old third-generation farmer, said of the delayed crop. Most of North Carolina was in an extreme drought as of May 5th, according to the State Drought Management Advisory Council. The state has a rain deficit of 12 to 20 inches, which has been building since last August, said Assistant State Climatologist and Advisory Council member Corey Davis. "The drought conditions are the worst the state has seen since 2007, Davis said. By the end of that year, more than 5 million North Carolinians had been asked to restrict water usage, and the state's agriculture industry saw $537 million in damages, according to the NC State Climate Office. "Recent rain showers have helped during the current drought, although water restrictions are in place for several cities, including Raleigh and Charlotte. Farmers, meanwhile, could experience the drought's impacts for months. The U.S. Department of Agriculture designated 82 of North Carolina's 100 counties as natural disaster areas because of drought conditions," Governor Josh Stein announced last month. Robinson said the ground was just wet enough to plant corn, zucchini, and squash a month later than usual. "Drought isn't the only obstacle for North Carolina farmers. They are also dealing with increased costs for fuel and fertilizer, spurred by the United States war with Iran and the subsequent closure of the Strait of Hormuz. The Middle Eastern waterway is a major global trade route for fuels like oil and natural gas. The cost of diesel used to power tractors and farm equipment shot up to an average of $5.81 per gallon in April, according to AAA. It was the state's highest average ever recorded by the Auto Association and an increase of $2.43 a gallon from 12 months ago. As of May 13th, the average price of diesel in North Carolina was $5.43 per gallon. Between February and March, the price of fertilizer increased dramatically in the southeast, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The cost of a ton of urea ammonium nitrate fertilizer, a liquid that can be combined with other materials like pesticides, increased by 24%. The price of a ton of urea fertilizer, a solid fertilizer commonly used on corn, wheat, rice, and cotton fields, increased by 41%. "We're just trying to do the best we can with what we've got in a time like this and keep on going in hopes that things will get better," Robinson said. "That's the old saying in farming. Next year will be better." Hoping for rain. Scott Shelton is also trying to keep going. When Shelton opened Heal the Land Farm in the Bladen County town of Tar Heel in 2023, he wanted it to be bomb-proof, capable of surviving any hardship. The 46-year-old retired Special Forces soldier said he chose to raise grass-fed longhorn cattle because they thrive even when the foliage they eat is less than ideal. "They will consume anything, from grass to briars." At this point in May, the grass on the 65 acres of land used for grazing should be thick and at least an ankle high, Shelton said. But it's short and brittle. Walking across the fields sounds like stepping on dried leaves. If the rain doesn't start falling and we start growing grass, I think inevitably I'll have to offload some cows to be able to keep the ones that I might need healthy, Shelton said. It's a painful thought for Shelton, who described the herd as part of his family. He can identify them by name from acres away. Fiesta, a white and tan cow that had wild tendencies as a calf. Milky Way, a black and white cow that has beef with the farm's resident turkey, Tom. Carne Asada, Chick-fil-A, Nancy, Quinceañera. Shelton said his troubles began over the winter, which brought snow and ice to southeastern North Carolina. He used his more than 200 bales stockpile of hay to keep the cows fed. Robinson also said the harsh winter contributed to his strawberries' lackluster performance. While the region saw bitterly cold temperatures, Davis said the winter precipitation didn't do much to improve the soil's moisture level. This spring has been amongst the hottest and driest recorded in state history. North Carolina averaged less than an inch and a half of rain in April, according to the state climate office. The state typically sees almost 4 inches based on averages from 1991 to 2020. More than 2 inches of rain have fallen in some parts of the state so far in May, according to the Southeast Regional Climate Center. Others have seen less than half an inch. The National Weather Service predicts the state won't see more than a tenth of an inch in the coming days, and Davis said the rest of the month feels like a toss-up. Rainfall in the weeks and months ahead is crucial to easing the drought, Davis said, particularly in the western and central regions of the state that are experiencing the driest conditions. A wetter-than-average June would go a long way in stopping the bleeding of this drought, he said. Farmers in western North Carolina are still recovering from Hurricane Helene, which caused $5 billion in agricultural losses, NC Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler told the State House Agriculture and Environment Committee on May 6. Currently, the U.S. seasonal drought outlook predicts conditions will persist through the end of July in North Carolina. Davis said there is a chance that weaker storms along the state's coastline could bring enough rain this summer to keep the drought from worsening. Forecasters at Colorado State University's Department of Atmospheric Science predict a below-average hurricane season this year. Declining income. Most southern farmers polled by the American Farm Bureau Association in April said they're unable to afford all the fertilizer they need for the rest of 2026. Sean Harding, president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau, said most of the state's corporate farmers can't add a surcharge to their products to offset rising costs. The prices of goods like soybeans, cotton, and corn are determined by the global market they are traded on, he said. Farmers are price takers, not price makers, Harding said. What Harding calls retail farms, like Robinson's, can increase prices to offset some of the costs, but are still limited by competition with grocery store prices. Robinson said he hasn't increased his prices to keep up with rising costs because he knows his customers are also hurting financially. He charges $6 for a quart of strawberries, $13 for 2 quarts, and $22 for a gallon, but he's making less money now. Net farm income across the country is expected to decline by $4.1 billion this year, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's hard to withstand everything we have to face, Robinson said. We're just hanging in there the best we can at the moment. Davis said he knows it's tough for farmers right now, and harsh conditions are likely to continue through the summer. But we do like the chances of at least seeing some improvements by the end of this year and into next winter, if we're still seeing droughts stick around by then, he said. Holding on for fall. Robinson said he took over the family farm full-time 3 decades ago. Before then, he was farming part-time while working in a pharmaceutical plant on the border of New Hanover and Pender counties. Out of my family of four, I was the only one who had an interest in doing it, Robinson said. I just love to watch things grow. Under Robinson's leadership, the farm went from selling produce from a pop-up tent to a large barn. Besides produce and flowers, the stand sells baked goods, jams, honey and ice cream. But Robinson said farming is not as fun as it used to be because of extreme weather and rising costs to do business. Shelton didn't grow up farming. Seeing empty grocery store shelves during the COVID-19 pandemic spurred him to start raising his own meat for his wife and four kids. Now, the 21-year Army veteran said caring for the cattle, chickens and other animals on the farm is his therapy. I don't want to quit on them, Shelton said. It's medicine for the soul. If enough grass doesn't grow on his fields and enough cattle farmers are in the same situation, Shelton said the cost of hay could go up due to low supply and high demand. Hay and diesel are the main expenses for Heal the Land Farm, Shelton said. He said he put $150 of fuel in his truck recently, which didn't even fill the tank. Other equipment, including all that's needed to butcher and process the cattle, also requires fuel. Shelton said he won't know until later this year how badly the drought impacted him. He's only in his fourth year of farming and said he's never experienced conditions like these. He's trying to hold on until fall. If there's going to be a problem, Shelton said, then that's when we'll start to feel it. Change of pace now. We're going to read an article about higher education. UNC Chapel Hill trustees reject hiring of tenured women's studies professor. And this is an article by Corey Dean. The UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees on Wednesday voted against hiring and granting tenure to a women's studies professor who had gone through the university's standard hiring process, an escalation of the board's actions against the lifetime appointments that are considered a hallmark of academia. Kieran Asher, the former chair of the Department of Women, Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, was set to be hired as a distinguished professor in the UNC Chapel Hill Department of Women and Gender Studies. Asher's potential hiring had been considered and approved by the Women's Studies Department, the College of Arts and Sciences, which houses the department, and a committee overseeing the appointment and tenure process. On Wednesday, she was part of a slate of six professors that the Board of Trustees considered for new tenured appointments. The board takes the final vote on all tenure cases after the provost signs off, according to a presentation former interim provost Jim Dean gave the trustees last summer. But when the board emerged from closed session on Wednesday, it only approved five of the outside hires, plus more than 25 promotions from within the university and a joint appointment. They considered Asher's appointment separately, and the majority of the trustees voted against hiring her in a voice vote. Two trustees, Ralph Meekins and student body president Devin Duncan, told the assembly they voted in favor of Asher's appointment. The trustees did not name Asher or the other professors up for appointment or promotion during the public votes because they were personnel matters. Multiple people told the assembly that Asher was the singled out case. In a Thursday email to the advisory board for the Women's and Gender Studies Department, obtained by the assembly, interim chair Tanya Shields said Asher's tenured hire was rejected. I do not have any information regarding the reasoning behind this decision. And when I asked whether an appeal was possible, I was told it is not. Dean Stoyer, UNC Chapel Hill's Vice Chancellor for Communications, said the university would not acknowledge the name of the person who was denied tenure, but he confirmed in an email to the Assembly that there is not an appeals process for tenure approvals after the Board of Trustees votes. Asher told the Assembly she learned her case had been denied when she saw her name was not included on the list of approved personnel actions after Wednesday's meeting. She applied for the job when it was advertised last academic year, looking for a change after more than a decade at UMass, and excited about the possibility of returning to North Carolina after earning her master's degree at Duke University in 1990. Everything about it was aligning really well, Asher said. Last week, though, Asher received a call from Provost Magnus Egerstedt, who told her he was going to put her hire up for the board's approval. Egerstedt assured Asher that her research and dossier were fine, she said, but he was concerned because the Board of Trustees for new hires at senior levels wanted to know about return on investment. Some UNC Chapel Hill trustees have criticized the common university practice of offering lifetime appointments to experienced professors, which is intended to protect their ability to conduct research without fear of repercussions. Some trustees have expressed concerns about the salary costs that such appointments demand of the university over time. Beth Morocco, chair of the UNC Chapel Hill faculty, said that argument doesn't hold water. She noted that Dean's presentation last July outlined to the board that tenure builds stability and reduces the costs associated with heavy turnover in faculty. Responding to a question from trustee Jim Blaine about whether there were arguments against tenure, Dean noted that tenure does impose a financial encumbrance on the university. Morocco argued that financial concerns about tenure should be addressed before jobs are posted, not after candidates have been vetted. If it's a cost savings, then it needs to happen much earlier in the process, she said. Duncan, the student body president, said he believes that cases that make it through the tenure process should get the board's approval unless they receive new information about the candidate that would make that person unworthy of consideration. That's why I voted yes, and I think that should be equally and standardly applied upon all candidates, Duncan said. Asher, whose UMass Amherst biography describes her as a biologist turned social scientist, also was seeking to join the Women's Studies Department at a fraught time for programs that study particular racial or gender groups. Last September, a women's studies professor was denied tenure at Harvard University, and some faculty there worried the move was evidence that the field would receive less support under the Trump administration. These are very strange times, Asher said. All kinds of things we fought against are being overturned. Morocco said the board's vote was part of a disturbing pattern that has emerged in recent years and could damage the university's standing. Tenure was at the center of the university's botched hiring of journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones in 2021. The UNC Journalism School had recruited Hannah-Jones, known for her work on the New York Times Magazine's 1619 project, to serve as a night chair, a prestigious professorship that typically comes with tenure. But the Board of Trustees chose not to take action on her tenure package, instead offering her a 5-year fixed-term appointment, after which she could be considered for tenure. The episode lit a firestorm at UNC Chapel Hill and became a national controversy. The board later reversed course and voted 9-4 to grant Hannah-Jones tenure. But she turned UNC Chapel Hill down and opted to accept a night chair position at Howard University instead. And UNC Chapel Hill later paid her nearly $75,000 to avoid a discrimination lawsuit. More recently, the board delayed votes to confer tenure on dozens of faculty last spring. The assembly obtained an email in which the then provost, Chris Clemens, wrote that Chancellor Lee Roberts had signed off on the measure to cut costs amid threats to funding at the state and federal levels. The board approved the cases after 2 weeks of outcry from professors. These events around tenure is a huge blow to the university's reputation, Morocco said, and also is going to make recruitment and retention of world-class faculty more difficult. Stoyer disputed that the UNC Chapel Hill trustees' recent actions on tenure amounted to a recurring pattern. He noted the board has conferred tenure to more than 290 professors since 2022. As we said repeatedly, tenure is a competitive imperative for Carolina, Stoyer said, adding, the university remains committed to recruiting and retaining top faculty and consistently reviews salaries and benefits to align offers with both our budget and current relevant market data. Nothing has changed in the university's tenure policies. Asher still has her job at UMass, where she has been on leave this year finishing a book. She said it was too early to say if there might be another opportunity to move to UNC Chapel Hill or if she would accept it if there was. She said the UNC Chapel Hill Women's Studies Department has been supportive and she worries about what the vote against her hire might signal for the faculty there. She also cautioned that other schools might follow suit. What the UNC Board of Trustees did today, Asher said, other boards can do tomorrow. Our final article today is also about education. How should math teachers teach math? By Corey Dean. 6 years ago, the UNC system tapped 8 education professors to develop a literacy framework that would set common standards for how North Carolina's public universities should instruct future educators to teach reading in elementary school classrooms. Teacher training programs had long lacked consistency in their approaches, and some were using outdated methods. The group's resulting 115-page report, released in February 2021, was just one piece of a years-long process that ultimately required system-level directives and state legislation to improve literacy education. Finally, 2 years ago, all of the system's educator preparation programs adopted the Science of Reading, a research-backed approach that emphasizes phonics and is now required in most states. System officials hope it doesn't take that long to revamp math teacher training. Our schools of ed got to where they needed to be based on those measures, Ashton Clemens, the UNC system's associate vice president of P-12 strategy and policy, said of the Science of Reading, and everyone in the state started talking about math. Those were part of Clemens' opening remarks at a gathering last month of education faculty from around the system, plus 11 math fellows, a group of professors that was tasked over the past year with developing an evidence-based framework for elementary math instruction in teacher preparation programs. Over 2 days at Carey's SAS Institute, the fellows shared with faculty the new standards and guidelines for implementing them in their schools. The goal of the framework, Clemens told the group, is to ensure the UNC system can prepare the strongest teachers of math, which should in turn provide better instruction for students. The goal of the framework, Clemens told the group, is to ensure the UNC system can prepare the strongest teachers of math. North Carolina students' grade level proficiency in math lags pre-pandemic levels, though it has steadily improved in recent years and has generally been higher than reading proficiency levels. State leaders have shown renewed interest in improving teacher training and student achievement. Governor Josh Stein and legislative leaders recently created a bipartisan Blue Ribbon Commission on Public Education. The State Department of Public Instruction is expected to release new K-12 math standards this summer, which it hopes will draw clearer ties between what students learn in the classroom and their experiences later in life. Those standards will replace the ones implemented after the state ditched the controversial Common Core principles that were a flashpoint in national education debates for years. The state legislature is considering a bill to require public schools to implement high-quality mathematics instruction in elementary and middle schools, a measure akin to the state's Read to Achieve program that requires students to read at grade level by the end of third grade. Clemens noted that there is no legislative mandate for the UNC system to improve its math instruction for future teachers, but officials chose to take up the task proactively. Clemens believes North Carolina is one of the few state university systems in the country, if not the only one, to do so without intervention from lawmakers. This whole work is our effort to say we in the UNC system have experts that can and are working together to meet the needs of our state, she said. While the reading overhaul around the country has emphasized making sure elementary students learn phonics, the summit discussion focused less on specific content that math classes should include and more on ensuring that teachers know how to keep students from getting discouraged by the subject. The framework is divided into two sections, a set of course guidelines which define specific skills that future teachers should gain in their math education classes, and program guidelines which define how the curriculum in math educator preparation programs should be designed and sequenced. For instance, the first course guideline, referred to as a foundation, states that courses for future elementary math teachers should ensure that teacher candidates develop mathematical knowledge for teaching, a specialized approach that equips future educators with a deep understanding of math concepts and how to teach them to students. To help achieve that aim, the UNC System Guideline for Teacher Preparation Programs states that they should include at least 165 hours of instruction focused on building both mathematics content knowledge and effective pedagogy for teaching mathematics. The framework also argues that the program should equip teachers with productive mathematics teaching dispositions or a positive attitude toward math and teaching it to students. The framework says teachers should present math as a useful discipline of logic, problem-solving, and sense-making. Teachers should also demonstrate resilience in math by using any mistakes they make as learning opportunities for their students. Our elementary school teachers are the first people who have a major impact on shaping students' mathematical identities and their confidence in math, said Katie Johnston, an assistant professor of mathematics at Winston-Salem State University and one of the fellows who worked on the framework. Lindsay Britt, an assistant professor of education at Elizabeth City State University who taught high school math and was also a school administrator before moving to higher education, said she saw firsthand how critical solid math skills at the elementary level were for students as they progressed through their education. Establishing confidence in math early could have lasting impact, said Britt, who also served as one of the math fellows. They will not avoid a career later in life because they didn't want to go into a STEM field because it had math, Britt said. We want to try to get rid of that negativity around the idea of math. To begin implementing the framework, each program performed a self-assessment developed by the fellows to determine how its curricula stack up to the new guidelines. They will identify areas for improvement to measure over the next year, Clemens said. The framework notes that it should be used as an instrument for programs to iteratively self-reflect and make changes to their instruction as needed. It gives opportunities for conversations at each university about what we need to do to make improvements, Britt said, and that's a start. This article was written by Corey Dean, who is the Higher Education Reporter for the Assembly and co-anchor of our weekly Higher Education newsletter, The Quad. She previously worked at the News and Observer, where she covered higher ed as part of the state government and politics team. She grew up in Eflund and graduated from UNC Chapel Hill. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We do hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.